The Ozarks at Large podcast is made possible by KUAF's contributing listeners. Support from individual listeners in our community helps pay for the cost of producing and distributing this podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast and other digital media produced by KUAF, you can make a contribution at supportkuaf.com.
Good afternoon. This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright School of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Later today on 91.3, on All Things Considered, a decade after the housing crisis, realtor Sean Hahn still has flashbacks. During the wildest days of the bubble, he'd list a house and get 12 offers by noon. After the bust, there were seriously low moments, like people stealing copper pipes. Hahn and other survivors of the housing crash on lessons learned 10 years later. Plus, the latest news about the U.S. response in Syria this afternoon from 3 to 6 on All Things Considered 91.3. This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, April 16th, 2018. I'm Kyle Kellums. Tonight on the University of Arkansas campus, we can consider the American Civil War not just in domestic terms, but as an event with global context. This year's Timothy Donovan Lecture will be delivered by Andrew Zimmerman, professor of history at George Washington University. The address begins tonight at 6 in Giffel's Auditorium in Old Main and is free and open to the public. Later this afternoon on our show, the second March for Science in Fayetteville this weekend didn't draw the people last year's march did, but organizers say there are reasons to be optimistic about the commitment to science in 2018.
So the NIH is actually the most heavily funded organization in the world for like biomedical research. And so they were part of the omnibus spending bill to get an increase in scientific funding.
That story in about 8 minutes on Ozarks at Large. First up this afternoon, elementary school students in Bentonville who chronically disrupt school environments are being assigned to two new behavior classrooms. As Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, alternative learning environments, including in-school behavior rooms, are commonplace. The Bentonville classrooms, however, are using state-of-the-art behavioral interventions.
R. E. Baker Elementary School children play outdoors this warm spring morning in Bentonville, running wild or gathered in tight packs, talking about things. Inside the school, lines of children change classrooms. But one room is a designated behavior classroom where chronically disruptive students from across the school district are sequestered. Behavior classroom teacher Stephanie Seedsma says this morning, no children are present to protect their identity.
Because the word behavior room can have like a stigma attached to it sometimes, we decided to call it Club Academy, which stands for cultivating learning using best practices.
Seedsma stands on a thick purple carpet beneath a whiteboard where children sit for a read-aloud time. Rows of classroom desks have been removed, replaced by half a dozen workstations. The classroom can accommodate up to 6 kids. Along with grade-level math, literacy, and science, each child receives positive behavior interventions.
Which works on students' mindfulness and being like flexible with their thinking. So it helps with their social skills and their ability to communicate with other people.
Entry-level children are kept apart at first, she says.
Separated out from the classroom. They're still part of the classroom, but they have to learn that they have to stay in their space and learn where their personal space is and asking permission to leave their personal space without just having free range of the room.
Classrooms are kept physically clear for a reason, says Lindsay Lovelady, Bentonville School District's behavioral specialist.
Because when students come in, we might have some difficulties that we have to work through. And that could mean that we have to clear things out of the room. So we want just what's needed.
Lovelady, who's also a certified behavior analyst, says the classroom accommodates second through fourth graders. A second classroom at Sugar Creek Elementary serves little ones, K through first grade. To be referred to the class, children first undergo rigorous functional behavior assessments, measuring just how they're acting out and how often.
If they're aggressive towards their peers or to their staff members, property destruction, elopement, sometimes we've got kids that run and they run out of their classrooms, run out of the buildings, that kind of thing. There can even be verbal aggression, which verbal threats to others. It's not a one-time doer, it is repeated over time. So it's happening a lot.
Tamara Gibson serves as executive director of elementary education. She says the district decided to install two behavior classrooms because of escalating bad conduct especially among the youngest children at the elementary level in the district.
Behaviors that, I'm going to be honest, require us maybe to clear a room.
Lindsay Lovelady links a nationwide uptick in maladaptive behavior to screens, smartphones, iPads, digital games, cable TV, at too young an age.
So think about when you go out to dinner and you go and look around the restaurant, how many parents are on their cell phones, how many kids have a game in front of them?
According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, kids ages 8 to 18 spend on average 7.5 hours per day in front of screens. As a consequence, they play less outdoors, talk less to family, and that isolation, Tamara Gibson says, negatively impacts classroom environments.
It's very verbal and very interactive. There's a lot of sharing, and so when children come, and that's just not an environment they've been exposed to, for some children, they find it very hard to adapt.
Children act out in frustration, she says, unable to properly express their needs. Seedsma, Lovelady, and their teams of paraprofessionals, using state-of-the-art evidence-based practices, teach the children what's called emotional intelligence, how to recognize, verbalize, and regulate emotions to make positive choices and act with compassion towards classmates and teachers. Compliant children at first are rewarded with certain allowances, for example, allowed to attend lunchroom, recess, and special events. The goal is to integrate students back to their home schools. But what about stigma?
The general population doesn't necessarily understand that they're in a behavior classroom, I don't think, from my understanding. We haven't had that issue come up currently.
Tamara Gibson says students and families are made to understand the behavior classroom assignment is temporary.
It's difficult for parents to understand, to know that their child may need services where we can help with the behaviors, but also our parents, we've had so many say, we so appreciate the support.
R.E. Baker Elementary Principal Josh Draper says he first meets with parents to inform them about the intensive services their child will receive, but also asks key questions.
I first start out, tell me about your kid. Tell me about the dreams you have for your child. Now tell me what's going on. Those questions are really important because in the end, they still are an individual and they're still loved and cherished. And we have to work with that dream and that hope. And then we talk about what we're going to do to get there.
Counseling support offered to families, he says. Seedsma and Lovelady also collaborate with parents. Tamara Gibson says the district applies frameworks provided by the National Technical Assistance Center on positive behavioral interventions.
We identify what are expected behaviors in every area of school, in the classroom, in the hallway, at recess, at lunch. Those are developed on a school-wide level, and every school has their expected behaviors. But we know that children don't necessarily always come to school knowing how to make that behavior happen in the right way. So we're taking a much more concerted effort to teach children those appropriate behaviors.
Trish Wood, the district's 504 program coordinator, says the children appreciate all the extra attention.
They haven't experienced much success in the regular ed setting. So one of the biggest things that we try to do is to give them success. And when they experience the success in this environment, then they just thrive. They become different children.
Wood serves the special education population, which comprise 11% of the district's 17,000 students. Principal Josh Draper says children with disabilities may also be assigned to a behavior classroom.
It's based upon the behavior. The percent of loss of instructional time that's lost in the classroom, if that percentage is high because the behaviors are being exhibited, we could consider an alternate placement like a club academy class. It has no difference to do with the disability or whether they're gen ed kid at all.
Gen ed is jargon for general education population. Low-functioning children with disabilities, Gibson says, are excluded from the program. The cost of the two elementary-level behavior classrooms is around $225,000, including salaries, benefits, and materials. None of the 9 children currently enrolled have yet to return to their home schools. Children unable to assimilate back into their general education environment will progress to the next behavior class level. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
You can share this story with others through email or social media by sharing links you can find at KUAF.com or OzarksAtLarge.com. And you can always catch up with Ozarks at Large as a podcast, too. You can subscribe to us for free through services like iTunes and Stitcher. This is 91.3 KUAF. Last April, there were several marches for science around the country, drawing thousands of people in support of fact-based scientific research and funding for that research. The marches came after a campaign season during which many people became concerned about the future of science education in the country. A Fayetteville version of that march last year had hundreds of participants. This past Saturday, the 2018 Fayetteville March for Science had fewer people, about 70, marching from East Avenue to campus. A year's distance from an election cycle and a cold for April Saturday with wind chills below 40 may have dampened participation, but not the spirit of those marching.
What do we want?
Evidence-based research.
When do we want it?
After peer review.
This march had similarities with other marches that have taken place in the past few months. Clever signs, like the one that read, Proud STEMinist. Some marchers wore their white lab coats. But the speakers at the end of the route, addressing the marchers inside Hillside Auditorium on the University of Arkansas campus, touched on a few topics not always discussed at these kinds of activities. Descartes, Apostle Paul, the concept of false equivalency, the poet W.H. Auden, nonlinear thinking, the Laffer curve used in economics, mathematics, and faith. Lance Miller, an assistant professor of mathematics at the University of Arkansas and one of the speakers Saturday, told the audience all of what was being discussed had something in common, a respect for truth.
Science is about uncovering a truth, and that truth in particular is indifferent to our understanding of it. And I think this is part of why we all march for things like today, because it doesn't matter what policies get passed in the sense that the science will still be correct or not after the fact.
Miller told the marchers that science and learning about science is important not just for professional mathematicians, scientists, and engineers.
You probably will never have to factor a quadratic ever in your life after you leave school or when you get a job or something like this, unless you work in a very selective scientific field. But learning the complex process, okay, changes your mind and how you think. And then you can be like Abraham Vault when you get into a problem, and use common sense and use your intuition. It's kind of like running, if you're learning how to play the piano, right? You do a lot of scales and things like this. That's not really fun. It's not a lot of music. But you become better at manipulating the piano, and then you can express music through that.
This year's Fayetteville March for Science was organized by a pair of undergraduate students at the U of A, Zachary Renfro, a biology and biochemistry major, and Braylee Gaddis, a chemistry major. Braylee says the marches in 2017 and this past weekend may have been inspired by concerns for the future of science and for funding of science, and those concerns are not misplaced, but she says there is room for optimism.
So the NIH is actually the most heavily funded organization in the world for like biomedical research, and so they were part of the omnibus spending bill to get an increase in scientific funding. So it's good for us to have that type of research because, you know, we could find the next vaccine, we could find the next, who knows, cure for cancer. So just for health perspectives, it's, you know, great for everybody to be engaged and for them to know that science is important because it could actually save your life.
Co-organizer Zachary Renfro cautions, though, that marches for science continue to be important.
Even though we've made a lot of progress the past year, we shouldn't let our guard down. So it's important just to keep it up each year and make sure that our elected representatives do know that science is still important to us.
This year's March for Science in Fayetteville ended with instructions about communicating with elected officials and candidates about the importance of science and science funding. As speakers mentioned more than once Saturday, by the time a 2019 march may materialize, there will have been midterm elections. The number of energy customers investing in solar power systems in Arkansas surged last year, according to a new report. As Bobby Ampazon with Arkansas Public Media reports, the news comes just ahead of a big rate decision regulators have to make on the matter.
Each year, electric utilities and co-ops in the state count up their number of net metering customers. These are customers generating power through windmills or more likely solar systems who can make electricity and push it out onto the grid, actually reversing their electrical meter. Last year, that number jumped by more than half. John Bethel directs the Public Service Commission, the agency that oversees utilities and determines rates.
Well, more people are installing facilities, obviously, and I think it's consistent with the fact that the costs are declining.
The costs are dropping, but how fast and how much Arkansans adopt home energy systems is a rising concern to legacy utilities like Entergy and SWEPCO and the state's electrical cooperatives. They're investing in huge megawatt and gigawatt solar and wind fields too, but they lose money when people make their own. Katie Niebaum directs the Arkansas Alternative Energy Association.
The previous 3 years when we were looking at the data, there's been steady growth, 20%, 28%. Over the previous 3 years in terms of the number of net metering systems. But in this past year, it skyrocketed to 56%.
Bethel says it's not a coincidence. Solar generators, these net metering customers, they're credited for excess electrical generation. Right now, it's even a one-to-one credit. But the commission is on the verge of deciding whether to make it a lot less. But that lower rate would only affect investors who come after. In other words, the time to buy is now.
Yeah, they want to do renewable energy. And what's on the docket is the question of who's going to do it.
That's Terry Tremwell, chairman of Pika Solar Company in Fayetteville. He's saying that everyone thinks solar is a good investment. Utilities, too. They have huge projects in the works. The question is, who will do it?
The fear of changing the net metering rules, changing the net metering ratio, is that it will reduce people's choice.
The number of Arkansas net metering customers affected here is about 1,000. The total number of electricity customers in the state is well over 1 million. In Little Rock, Bobby Ampazon, Arkansas Public Media.
It is Monday, April 16th, 2018. This is Ozarks at Large. Becca Martin Brown is the features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette. She has filed her taxes?
Yes.
Very good.
I was early. I did them like Tuesday of last week.
Oh, well, there you go. All right.
And for me, that's early.
There you go. All right. Tell me what we have this week.
This week. Tomorrow, we have I'm With Her.
At the Walton Arts Center with Smoking the Mirror supporting them.
Exactly. Trio of women who do...
Oh, Americana, folk.
Roots.
Yeah.
Stuff.
Yeah.
And are really well known. That starts at 7. Tickets are $32.50, and look what you get for it. There's also a jazz concert with the UAFS Jazz Cats and Jazz Band at 7:30 at the ArcBest Performing Arts Center in Fort Smith. It's $8. On Wednesday, sandwiched in at the Shiloh Museum at noon with nature photographer Terry Stanfill.
Mm-hmm.
That's free. And as I say, every time they have cookies. Art at the Bank. A new show going up at the First National Bank of Northwest Arkansas in Bentonville. Zeke Taylor is the curator for that space. And this time the works include artist Jaquita Ball and Edward Robeson III.
All right.
On Thursday, the Art Feeds Community Mural will be under construction at Arvest Bank in Siloam Springs starting at 9:30. And then there's a Discover the Grounds at Crystal Bridges where they'll be talking about honey.
Honey?
From 6 to 8 o'clock, it's a honey tasting workshop with somebody from Red Bee Farms, and that's $55. And Arts Live Theater is doing Aladdin Jr. And that happens at 7 o'clock on Thursday and Friday, 2 and 7 on Saturday, and 2 on Sunday at the Arts Center of the Ozarks in Springdale.
Sounds great. That's a good week. Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown, features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. The 18th annual Cherishing Children Glow Run is Friday, April 20th in downtown Rogers. This family-friendly nighttime event features a one-mile fun walk, 400-yard superhero dash, a chip-timed 5K glow run, and a chip-timed 10K. Proceeds benefit the victims of child abuse seen at the Children's Advocacy Center of Benton County. CACBentonCO.com for more.
Ahead on Ozarks, Zoe Nessel says the internet and social media have changed some of the ways we should think about the law.
All of these various developments are starting to impact how we think about the law. And I think social media is a big part of that as well.
That's ahead on this edition of Ozarks at Large. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Cleanup continues after damaging storms hit the region Friday afternoon. The National Weather Service confirms an EF tornado touched down in Mountainburg Friday afternoon. Two other EF1 tornadoes touchdown in the River Valley. Governor Asa Hutchinson traveled to Mountainburg this weekend to survey the damage there. Through his Twitter account, the governor is praising the work done by local officials to help those affected by the storms, and he says warning systems that are in place saved lives. Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton says this weekend's missile strikes against sites in Syria should serve as an indication that weapons of mass destruction do not give countries a military advantage against the United States and its allies. In a statement he released this weekend, the Republican senator wrote, "The strikes should also serve as a warning to leaders of Iran and North Korea." Arkansas's congressional delegation is announcing more than $48 million in federal funding is approved for Arkansas to rebuild and repair roads and critical infrastructure damaged from heavy rains and floods in 2017. The Arkansas State Highway Department will receive $40 million for those repairs, while the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers will be given $5 million. Benton, Madison, and Washington counties are among the locations that are earmarked for infrastructure repairs.
With the Department of Arkansas Heritage, I'm Mark Chris of the Arkansas World War I Centennial Commemoration Committee. 100 years ago, in April 1918, anti-German sentiment reached into Arkansas's schools. On April 8th, Fort Smith's Typographical Union No. 219 passed a resolution calling for the school board to suppress all German studies in the public schools at once in view of this war with the Germans and the cruelty she has imposed upon her victims. The Little Rock School Board dropped German classes on April 13th, with Superintendent R.C. Hall saying, "Since the last drive of the Germans, the sentiment against anything German has become so keen that it seemed best to eliminate the teaching of German at once." Johnson County's Catholic Board of Education stopped teaching German in its parochial schools on April 20th. At the same time, an editorial in the Arkansas Gazette decried the Little Rock Board's decision, saying it disrupted student schedules and, "No complaint has been made that the German books used at the Little Rock High School are tainted text." To learn more, visit ww1arkansas.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me at the Carver Center for Public Radio is John Jetter, who is the music conductor, director, and I think a few more things at the Fort Smith Symphony. Welcome back.
How are you?
I'm good. You?
I'm fine.
We are in April, which means a couple of things. One we're going to talk about today, one we'll talk about later this month. You can see the end of this season approaching. You can see the beginning of next season approaching.
Yes.
Let's talk about the end first, and we'll talk about the beginning later this month.
Okay. Sounds good.
Next concert up celebrates the bicentennial of the founding of Fort Smith.
That's right. It's on Saturday evening, April 21st. There are literally single-seat tickets available. So if you don't mind sitting by yourself... There's one seat in row one and another seat in row 27. You know, it's one of those
right things.
But I mean, it's, you know,
well, you wouldn't
it's
be sitting,
sold out.
You wouldn't
you
be
know.
Sitting by yourself. You just wouldn't be sitting with perhaps the person you came with.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. But I mean, technically, it's a sold out concert. It's been for a while. But yes, we're honoring the bicentennial of the city of Fort Smith with a real fun concert. It's a mix of Western music, of course. We have to talk about that heritage. So we're doing music from the Magnificent Seven, the original, the Elmer Bernstein. We're doing a lot of Elmer Bernstein. I didn't quite think of it that way, but the music from the original True Grit, which is wonderful, Elmer Bernstein.
Right.
We're doing music from the John Wayne film, The Cowboys. That's a John Williams piece. And
one of the few films in which John Wayne dies.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And we are performing a new work called From Disparate Lands by a wonderful composer named Philip Schroeder, who we wanted an Arkansas-based composer. So he was Arkansas-based until just a few months ago. So he wrote the piece while he was still living here. But it's a real pretty work, and an exciting aside to it is the work is going to be included in a time capsule that's going to be placed somewhere in Fort Smith that's going to be buried and then, I guess, exhumed 100 years from now.
The tricentennial.
Yeah. So we've got a kind of a special score, and I think I'm going to do a letter saying, you know, this is from your ancestors, and I think that'll be sort of fun. What's really neat about the concert is we are performing with the Crumbs, and the Crumbs have been featured on KUAF,
yep.
I think, a number of times. They are a wonderful bluegrass band that has been in Fort Smith. It's a Fort Smith-based band for a number of years.
Write songs steeped in history.
That is correct. So it was a perfect fit to have them come and perform with us. And I like the fact that you can see them performing everywhere in clubs and bars and restaurants. And typically, you don't see folks who are doing those sort of gigs on the symphony stage. You
right.
just don't. And it needs to change. And we're all doing music in all of our own ways. So they'll be performing some songs that are about the history of Fort Smith. And then we're also including the Ben Miller Band, which is a band that has roots in our area.
Joplin.
And two members live in Van Buren.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a very unique style. They've coined it as Ozark Stomp, and it's kind of a gritty, rock country sort of bluegrass-ish style. Really good stuff. And we have wonderful Dave Holland, who's one of the members of the Crumbs, did all the orchestrations for the Crumbs works. Don and Terry Bailey, who are musical pillars in Fort Smith and the jazz world, they do a lot of arranging for us. So they arrange the orchestral pieces for a Ben Miller Band.
That's April 21st.
Yes.
Go ahead and call if you want tickets.
If you are okay to not sit with the person who you're sitting with, there's 12 tickets or
okay.
something left. And you can go to fortsmithsymphony.org and click buy tickets, and that would be the best way to do it.
Can you also get on a list, like say we waited too long, and if somebody on the 20th realizes that they've double booked themselves, it's also the nephew's
That's possible.
Birthday
they could call.
Or bar mitzvah, and they have to cancel.
Right.
Okay.
Right. They could do that.
All right.
Yeah.
So now, the finale of the season will feature music of Florence Price.
Yes.
Are there more tickets for this, or are we still?
Seating is limited. There are some tickets available.
Okay.
And yeah, because of just the sign of the times, because of Urgene Kongs, who's been on the air, her recording of who she's our concertmaster, her recording of the Florence Price violin concertos, there's just been a flourishing sudden interest really in the last year in Florence Price.
New York Times, The New Yorker, the BBC, NPR. Yep.
That's right. And she was born and raised in Little Rock. She was the first African-American female concert composer, to be recognized as such, the first person to write symphonies that were performed by a major symphony orchestra. So, and what's so important, I think, for us is she's an Arkansan. So the Fort Smith Symphony is starting a project of recording all four of her symphonies and some other of her orchestral works for Naxos International. It's sort of a follow-up to our William Grant Still project for Naxos. And the start of this is our concert on May 12th, and we'll be performing her first symphony, which is a beautiful work, and we'll be performing her fourth symphony, and that will be the world premiere performance.
The folks there in the venue will be hearing it for the first time
anywhere. Yes. Yeah. We have some people, I think, from Denver who are coming in, and some from Chicago because of the New York Times articles. And it's this event has received a fair amount of recognition because it's so timely now, the interest in inclusion in classical music, and a lot of female composers are being featured. However, it's just great music.
Sure. Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so you haven't heard this yet. You've seen the music, but you yourself haven't heard it.
Well, no, I cheated a little bit. The arrangers who took her original manuscript mm-hmm. and made the set of parts, they were able to make a sort of a rough MIDI version.
Okay.
So there is an electronic, like digitized version.
So
I sort of have a general idea. But
that first rehearsal, when it's live musicians, they're in front of you, that'll be the first time you've heard it
yes.
that way. I mean, because if you were going to do Tchaikovsky, whatever.
Yeah.
You've probably heard that
sure,
piece before.
Exactly.
Performed by somebody on a CD or something. This,
Yeah, oh,
and
yeah.
I know this isn't the first time you've heard of world premiere, but what's that like?
Oh, I really enjoy it. We do like in the case we were talking earlier about Philip Schroeder's mm-hmm. piece. We actually commission a lot of pieces.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
So that's really fun, and it's so great to hear it for the first time. In this case, it's sort of like a commission. It's not, because the piece has been around since 1945. A typical commission, the composer's right there. I won't have that.
True.
But, yeah, it's a really neat experience to hear it and to see how the orchestra reacts to it.
Is there any room for surprise for you because you've read it, and if you've heard a MIDI?
There's a lot of room. Surprise.
To your ears?
Oh, absolutely, okay. Yeah, because things like how the orchestration actually really works, sure, that's all very new. And balance things you might have to adjust or think, oh, I'm going to have to address X. Mm-hmm. And then when it's done acoustically and we're on stage, like, okay, that's fine.
You know what's interesting is because almost any concert that I go to, I'm hearing something for the first time. You know, I haven't heard the complete library of Mahler or Beethoven sure. or anybody, or John Williams even.
Sure.
So almost every patron you have is probably having that experience every concert. There's
yes.
something
yeah, sure.
we haven't heard.
Exactly.
Do you think that is good for a conductor or a musician to also experience that in
oh,
preparation?
Oh, yeah. Well, and if you think about really the tradition of music, it's about performing and it's about playing new pieces. Mm-hmm. This whole idea, particularly for us talking about symphony, is, you know, this canon of works, and you know, you're always playing, you know, music from the past. That's great, but really, even for those composers, or especially for those composers, when Brahms was having his pieces performed, you might have a quote-unquote old piece by Beethoven, but that was kind of like, well, you know, where's all the new stuff?
Right.
Let's hear all the new. And we've really gotten away from that. It's really unfortunate, and that's a whole other subject as to why, but I think it's really important to always hear new things. Well, if I want to hear something new, I can listen to a recording, yes, but as we've talked about a million times, it's very different.
Yes.
Totally different experience to hear it live.
All right. How can people find out more about the last two concerts of this season?
The easiest way would be fortsmithsymphony.org. Information okay. and also tickets.
And the recordings of the Florence Price, when might we begin to see those? I know this is a process.
Yeah. It can take up to a year to release.
That's not so bad. As I get older, that doesn't sound so
yeah,
bad.
Really. I think, and of course, you know, I'm just saying this because you asked me, I wouldn't be surprised considering the interest in Florence Price. If you look at a lot of orchestras that are doing her music next year, there are a lot of orchestras that are doing her symphonies. I wouldn't be surprised if it comes out sooner because the timeliness of it is just perfect.
Okay.
Yeah.
Don't want to wish your life away, but when you come back later this month, we're going to talk about next season.
Okay.
All right. John Jetter. You're welcome. John Jetter is the music director and conductor of the Fort Smith Symphony.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Additional support comes from the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal, featuring banking and finance, including public and private banks by return on assets, plus local business news in Northwest Arkansas. The current edition and subscription information at 725-0394 or nwabusinessjournal.com. SONA, the Symphony of Northwest Arkansas, concludes its 63rd season May 5th at Walton Arts Center as SONA musicians perform Act 1 of Puccini's La Boheme, featuring a cast of hand-picked singers led by award-winning soprano Danielle Talamantes. Tickets at 443-5600 or sonamusic.org.
Tomorrow on Ozarks at Large, the militant grammarian returns to our studio to discuss ents as in ENTS, the confusion that can develop around words like incidents and incidents. But she says she had a hard time researching this topic.
When I entered my query into the search engine, I kept coming up with this. Ents are a race of beings in J.R.R. Tolkien's fantasy world, Middle-earth, who closely resemble trees.
A conversation with the militant grammarian about words, not Middle-earth, on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large at noon and 7 on 91.3, listener-supported KUAF. This is Ozarks at Large on your public radio station, 91.3. Digital media changes how we do several things. We shop differently, we communicate differently, learn about events locally differently, ingest media differently, even receive presidential declarations differently. Zoe Niesel thinks we even have to think about the law differently because of digital media. She is an assistant professor of law at St. Mary's University in San Antonio and recently came to the University of Arkansas to deliver a talk titled Hashtag Personal Jurisdiction, A New Age of Internet Context. During her visit, she came to the Carver Center for Public Radio to discuss how the internet has or can change how legal matters are resolved.
The idea, I think, in multiple areas of the law right now is the increases in technology, and you look at things like cloud-based computing, you look at things like artificial intelligence, bots, all of these various developments are starting to impact how we think about the law. And I think social media is a big part of that as well, and that's where the hashtag personal jurisdiction comes from.
What's an example of, say, social media influencing how we might think about the law differently or have to think about a different aspect of the law?
So my paper actually deals with an example of this. So there's this concept in the law called personal jurisdiction. And essentially what it does is it makes sure that a court can have appropriate power over a defendant. So if I get sued in Texas tomorrow, that's very appropriate. Texas is my home state, and so I might have to defend a lawsuit that arose anywhere in Texas. What we see happening with social media is when people make posts on social media or companies use social media to drive traffic to their websites or to their business or to promote name recognition, what effect should that have in terms of deciding what is a fair court for that individual or entity to be sued in?
All right, let's say I've done something here in Arkansas that makes you want to sue me.
All right.
You're in San Antonio. Aren't there procedures to figure out where it could be?
Oh, absolutely. So in the United States, we use a test that's based on something called minimum contacts. And so as the defendant, we would look to see what minimum contacts you had with the forum state. So you use the example of Arkansas, right? So I assume this is your home.
It
this is where
yes.
you intend to stay.
Yes.
And so that's a really easy question in that scenario because we'd say, look, this is your forum state, and we can actually sue you here for something you did anywhere because it's really fair for us to sue you where you're at home.
What if I was in Azerbaijan?
Well, that's another question, right? And so that gets into a lot of questions about international jurisdiction and various laws that govern how we bring foreign defendants into the United States or United States defendants into a foreign forum. But I think the more interesting question is, what if I sued you in Hawaii for something that you did in Arkansas? And your argument would be, why on earth are we in Hawaii?
You just asked my question. Why are we in Hawaii?
So I may want to be in Hawaii because I perceive some kind of advantage to being in Hawaii in terms of maybe there's a judge there, I think, who will give me a favorable ruling. Or maybe I'm just a bad person and I want to make it really inconvenient for you.
Well, okay, so I'm a neophyte when it comes to law, but that just doesn't seem right.
It doesn't seem right.
But it's possible?
Theoretically, yes, but what the court would do is say, look, did the defendant create minimum contacts with Hawaii? In the scenario we just discussed, I think the answer is no. And so that protects you as the defendant from having to fly out to Hawaii all the time and defend this lawsuit.
What would work to make me go to Hawaii?
Well, let's say you got in a car accident with me in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. And then I go back to Texas and you go back to Arkansas. Well, I might be able to see you in Hawaii because you made contact with Hawaii and the claim arose in Hawaii. And so now it seems more fair maybe that we could be in Hawaii as a jurisdiction.
And the world of social media blurs this more than pre-social media?
It really does. So starting in 1997, we created a test to determine when an internet website could create a minimum contact with a forum. And that test was a sliding scale. And at one end of the spectrum was what we would call a passive website. So imagine getting on a website and all it does is give you information about a topic. That's a passive website. And so if you access it here in Arkansas, we would say that website did not create personal jurisdiction in Arkansas. On the other end of the spectrum is what we would call an active website. And kind of the best example of that is a website that lets you make purchases.
Okay.
So that's like an online storefront. So if you buy something on the internet in Arkansas, the company that you bought it from probably created a minimum contact in Arkansas because you purchased an item over the internet. Problem is there's this huge middle ground between websites that provide some information, maybe don't let you complete a purchase, but have lots of other interactive features. Take Facebook, for example. You can post things, you can share them with others, you can blog on Facebook, you can do all these activities on Facebook. And the question is, if I am posting on Facebook from Texas, where can I be sued in the United States based on that posting?
I guess it depends what you might be sued for.
It certainly would depend on that. And under our traditional sliding scale test, it would be considered a middle ground. And so we'd have to look at the level of interactivity of Facebook. I really take issue with that test. I think if I'm posting on Facebook, I'm purposefully reaching out to a national audience. Mm-hmm. I know people can access Facebook anywhere. I want them to access it everywhere because presumably I want people to read what I posted. And so I would articulate in that social media scenario, there is personal jurisdiction and probably in a lot of places.
I could have read it in Arkansas. Someone could have read it in Hawaii. Someone could have read it in Duluth.
Absolutely.
Could it? And I don't know what you would have done to make us sue you. but could my friend in Honolulu, my friend in Duluth, and I all sue you in our separate states? Possibly, potentially?
Theoretically, yes.
Well, who's going to figure this out?
Well, that's a job for the court and the judge.
That just seems to be sort of roundabout logic that if you're trying to figure out jurisdiction, you're still going to have to go to someone's jurisdiction to figure out the jurisdiction?
Yes, and that's largely true even now.
Okay.
Right? So, again, if I sue you tomorrow in Hawaii, that Hawaii court is still going to have to analyze that you really don't belong in Hawaii as a defendant. Right. So that really doesn't change. But what I think should change is the internet is no longer the type of experience we can put in buckets. So even the most passive website that exists, let's say you pull up a website and all it does is give you a recipe. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a chance that that website is downloading cookies onto your computer. There's a chance that it has targeted advertisements based on your IP address or based on your browsing history. And so the traditional notion that we would base contacts on interactivity seems really outdated in the age of social media and in the age of all these other changes to the internet.
Are these conversations taking place with you and your colleagues?
I think so. Yes, increasingly so. And we see it across a lot of areas. But in this space in particular, I think people are realizing the test we use was created in 1997. We're 20 years past that. And in terms of changes to the way we use the internet, changes to what the internet looks like over that 20-year time span, something's got to give.
As a client, I want you – it's in my best interest that – you've got a pretty good idea of where to try it because we're talking about time and money.
Absolutely.
So you want to have a pretty good handle on this.
Oh, sure. And I think part of the problem we're dealing with now is there's very divergent positions because people don't really know how to read this technology. So I'm a lawyer, right? Mm-hmm. And I'll be the first to admit lawyers maybe with exceptions and probably with a lot of them maybe don't understand the internet at the way someone who's a software engineer who works in IT does. And so we're really making decisions about something we don't really understand.
Zoe Neitzel is an assistant professor of law at St. Mary's University in San Antonio, Texas, and was a recent visiting scholar at the University of Arkansas. While here, she delivered the talk, hashtag Personal Jurisdiction, A New Age of Internet Context. This is Ozarks at Large.
Walton Arts Center's Starlight Jazz Club will present trombonist Conrad Herwig Saturday, April 28th. Atop both the performing and jazz educational fields, Herwig's professional performance career includes big band stints with legendary figures, including Miles Davis, Tito Puente, Frank Sinatra, and many others. WaltonArtsCenter.org or 443-5600 for tickets.
The Arkansas Razorback softball team is celebrating a program first, a series win over perennial softball power Alabama. Yesterday, Arkansas defeated the 15th-ranked Crimson Tide 6-3. That means they took two or three games this weekend at Bogle Park. The Razorbacks are now 33-9 overall, 8-7 in the SEC. The 33 wins, the most for the program since the team won 36 games in 2013. And the Razorbacks have 7 wins this year against ranked opponents. Just 9 games left in the regular season, beginning with a 3-game set at Auburn this weekend. The baseball Razorbacks also took 2 of 3 from their opponents this weekend in Fayetteville. Arkansas's pitching shut out South Carolina hitters twice Saturday for a doubleheader sweep, 2-0 and 3-0. Arkansas, ranked as high as number 3 in some national polls, next will host Missouri State tomorrow night at Baum Stadium at 6:30. And the University of Arkansas Fort Smith baseball team also claimed a series win this weekend, taking 3 of 4 from Rogers State in Claremore, Oklahoma. The Lions returned to Crowder Field Friday afternoon to start a 4-game series against St. Mary's University.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs. Frank Sun Seals was born August 14, 1942, in Osceola. The youngest of 13 children, Seals was called Little Son, as his father Jim was known around Mississippi County as Son. Jim Seals owned a long-running juke joint in Osceola called the Dipsy Doodle. In fact, Son Seals was born in the house behind the club. Jim was a veteran of the Medicine Show circuit and played piano, guitar, drums, and trombone, and also managed a West Memphis blues club in the 1930s prior to opening the Dipsy Doodle. Young Frank Seals got his start in music playing drums at the Dipsy Doodle before he was even a teenager. But Frank didn't stay at his dad's club long. In a few years, Frank's son Seals was touring with the likes of slide guitar great Earl Hooker and Albert King, also considered a hometown hero in Osceola. And Albert King's guitar playing, in part, inspired Son Seals to take up the instrument himself. By age 18, Seals was fronting his own band, playing guitar and singing. He performed at Little Rock's Chez Paris Club 4 nights a week, off and on for 4 years. When his father became sick, Seals returned to Mississippi County and played at Osceola's Blue Goose and Harlem clubs.
I said, hey, hey, baby, nah, nah, won't you call me up on the phone? Please call and tell me I can come back home.
After his father's death in 1971, Son Seals moved to Chicago to further pursue music and his welding of searing hard rock and blues guitar. It worked. As theatrical as it may sound, Seals got his first record deal after a clubgoer called a local label owner and held the phone towards the stage as Seals performed at the Flamingo Club on the south side of Chicago. His debut album on Chicago's Alligator Records came out in 1973. The New York Times called Son Seals the most exciting young blues guitarist and singer in years in a 1977 piece written by Little Rock native Robert Palmer.
I'm sitting here thinking, and these thoughts make me feel so sad.
The hard blues sound of Son Seals endeared him to a rock audience as well. But even with his crossover appeal, the Mississippi County native was rightfully touted as a carrier of the blues torch who is steeped in authenticity. He solidified his reputation through the end of the century. In 1981, Son Seals was nominated for a Grammy. He appeared in a TV commercial for Olympia Beer. He won Handy Awards in 1985, 1987, and 2001, and performed at the White House for President Bill Clinton. Seals also performed several times with the jam band Fish, who covered his song, Funky Bitch. Seals' license plate read Bad Axe. But Seals faced personal hardship as well. In 1997, as he slept, Son Seals was shot in the jaw by an ex-wife. 2 years later, part of Seals' left leg was amputated due to diabetes complications. Besides their shared nickname, Son, and both being musicians, Jim and Frank Seals also both liked large families. Frank left 14 children with his December 20, 2004 death at age 62 in Chicago. Frank's son Seals continued performing until just weeks before his death. As a latter-day bluesman, the influence of Son Seals will resonate louder than even his intense guitar sound.
here in its entirety, is Frank Sun Seals of Osceola with his composition Strung Out Woman from his breakthrough 1976 album, Midnight Sun.
I work all day, woman, out in a ditch, trying to get to mine just to get to your bitch. And when I get home, they look at me and frown. You don't do a damn thing, I'm a sturdy actor clown. But I love you, Lord, he knows I care. And that is why, that is why, that is why, that is why, that is why I've got the blues. It's sure I can't stand to lose. I work hard every day and bring you all my plate, but still you keep trying to run, pull me away. I guess I better pack up, child, and hit the road, cause I done got tired of carrying a load. But I love you, Lord knows I care. I'm gonna let your big fan back around, and you really appreciate having me around. Girl, I love you. Love knows I care. And that is why. That is why. That is why. That is why.
Frank Sun Seals of Osceola in Mississippi County with Strung Out Woman from his breakthrough second album from 1976. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of Experiment Station Studios. Producer is Keith Merks. Arkansongs, since 1998.
A listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. This is 91.3 KUAF. Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Strickler. We have one small correction from Friday's show in our report about how NAFTA negotiations and tariffs might affect Arkansas businesses and farms. We said that the Mexican elections were before the American midterm. Actually, it's reversed. First the American midterm elections, then the Mexican elections. So now you know. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for listening. Another brand new edition tomorrow at noon and 7 p.m.